Hello, everybody, and welcome to another great Fear Group webinar where we empower our plans. It's great to be here. Unfortunately, got some bad news today. My co-host, the one that's been around for months and months, well, not months, what am I talking about? Years. Ron Peck is not with us today. Ron has decided that he hates self-funding and does not want to be in the self-assured industry anymore. That is a joke. Ron is, I think, at a conference somewhere in Texas. He's using the fact that he can't dial in as an excuse to not be here, but I'm sure we'll do even better without him. Today's session is on keeping it under wraps, what the networks don't advertise. This is going to be interesting. We have a lot of people dialed in today. We're going to really get down to the nuts and bolts of what's going on with wrap network contracts, what you can do, what you can't do. So if you're interested in looking at alternatives to wrap networks, if you're interested in seeing what you, maybe you want to work with a wrap, what can you do versus what you normally can do with a regular, typical PPO network contract? This is the session for you because I believe, as many of us here believe, that most people in the self-assured industry don't realize that network contracts are not all the same. Wrap networks are very different than your typical networks where there isn't much flexibility. There's a lot more flexibility when it comes to the wraps. And we're going to focus on that today. With me, and this gentleman has been really taking Ron's place in a lot of different areas, is our staff attorney, Brady Bizarro. Say hello, Brady.
Hello, Brady.
One of our fan favorites, the wonderful, the smart, the amazing, Jennifer M. McCormick is here. Say hello, Jen.
Good afternoon.
You're supposed to say hello.
Oh, hello.
That's okay.
Sorry.
Don't worry.
We
might have to cut Jen out, too.
Yeah, we'll do that.
And this guy, I mean, he does, you know, he looks pretty good on this photo. He doesn't look that good in person, I don't think. But, I mean, you know, this is one of those where a lot of makeup and some editing has been done, for sure.
Some airbrushing. Yeah.
There's been airbrushing on that one. There's no question about it. John A. Jablon is here, our Director of Provider Relations, and he's the guy who actually reads and basically has seen every one of these wrap network contracts. Say hello, John.
Hello, John.
All right. As always, because we have Jen McCormick, we figured that we're going to first talk about what are the most frequently asked questions. What are the emails that we receive at pgcreferral@feargroup.com? Let's turn it over to Jen. Jen, take it away.
All right. Number one, what should we do if we think the terms of a stop-loss policy are unreasonable? Well, the first thing that you should do...
Not sign it.
is do your best at the outset prior to actually... as Adam mentioned, sign the contract to see what it is that you think might be unreasonable or problematic with the terms that exist and the policy that has been provided. So everyone here, whether it's the carrier or the TPA or the group or the broker or the consultant, has the same goal. We want to make sure that we can have self-funding be as viable as possible. So we know that with the same goal, there's a way that we can ultimately meet in the middle, whether it's putting together some terms that are going to make sense and give us a case-by-case opportunity to negotiate or to put a claim on hold until we can figure out a resolution for it. But the first thing to do is to make sure that you can address this prior to actually signing the contract.
Now, I know, Jen, I want to add this because for those, you know, Jen is still a millennial, I believe. I'm not sure.
I think actually
criteria.
Too old. Sadly.
She just says she's old. She did say
it's amazing. All right. Well, I thought she was. But one of the things that millennials don't do is actually talk, right? They do a lot of texting and stuff like that. So what I would recommend on this first one is to pick up the phone and talk to your stop-loss representative and talk about what areas of the policy are unreasonable. There are many things in those contracts that you will not be able to negotiate out of. But that's why there is so much competition. We can tell you that we have seen every type of stop-loss policy there is. Hard gaps, soft gaps, and so forth. So if you ever want to talk about, hey, we feel this one's unreasonable, do you know of others that aren't as unreasonable in regards to this particular provision? All you got to do is pick up the phone and call us or ask us via email. But, you know, this is not a situation where there's only one company out there. You got to just take it as is.
Right.
There are many options. There's a lot of flexibility. And we do know that many carriers have done endorsements or addendums, et cetera, where they have agreed to either mirror the plan or change certain provisions. So
right.
If you don't ask, nothing's going
to
change.
Right. Permission, not forgiveness here. Okay. Number two, do we need to restate a plan document after effecting a certain number of amendments? So we are usually guided by the ERISA guidelines here when we're looking at the actual amendments that exist and what the requirements are for when a restate becomes necessary. Even if it is a non-ERISA plan, those are the guiding rules. So the overall rule here is what's going to be reasonable for the plan participant. If they're looking at the plan document, is the number of amendments or the types of changes that are being amended or the document is being amended with, would it make sense to see that in an amendment? For example, if you're changing from grandfather to non-grandfather status, there's a lot of changes, a lot of benefit updates that need to be modified within the document. So that might make sense, even if it's amendment number one, that the document is restated. That way, it's easier for the plan participants to understand what their benefits are. The ERISA rules in particular are if there have been no amendments, you should restate your document every 10 years. I'd like to see a plan that hasn't had an amendment in 10 years. But if there are five or so amendments or six or so amendments, then the number is every 5 years that you should be restating those plan documents. But you should look at that on a case-by-case basis with the understanding of what do you think the average plan participant would understand and be guided by that. Number three. We're interested in adding coverage for stem cell therapy. What issues should we be concerned about?
Do a lot of people ask about this now?
So this is a hot topic. This is a new medical trend. People are really interested in how we can add this into our plan.
How expensive is it?
How expensive it is, and it depends on exactly what it is that is, what therapy is being utilized. So there's a possibility that this stem cell therapy could be considered E&I or experimental investigational. So if that's the case, you have to be careful to add that to the document, because you're going to invite a gap with your stop-loss policy.
Right. So, and a lot of stop-loss policies also have their own definition of what E&I is. So even if you cover it, they may not cover it.
Right. But there's also the possibility that depending on the actual, depending on the type of stem cell therapy that's being utilized, that it's possibly in relation or in coordination with a transplant. So if it's in coordination or collaboration with a transplant, then it's probably going to be an essential health benefit and thus not be considered E&I. So you really need to look at it on a case-by-case basis. But going back to question number one, this is going to be really relevant to make sure that you have this conversation with the carrier in advance. So whatever it is that you end up adding to your plan document, you're following the amendment rules, but you're also talking to everyone to make sure you're not inviting a gap in coverage. Make sense?
Yeah, great. Right. Great stuff.
All right, let's move on. Let's talk about some FMLA paid leave policies. So if you haven't heard us talk about this in the past, you should pay attention now. Based on the new tax rules, there is now an opportunity for 2018, 2019, and maybe beyond, we don't know, for an employer who is offering paid leave for FMLA to get a tax credit. So there are a lot of nuances to the specifics that are required, the eligibility requirements. Obviously, the employer has to be otherwise eligible to offer FMLA in the first place. They have to offer at least 2 weeks of paid leave for individuals who are out on FMLA. And they, most importantly, have to have a separate written policy outside of PTO, sick time, or any other vacation policy that they might have in place already. So this is separate. So most employers might already be offering an FMLA paid leave, but they're not aware that they can take advantage of this tax credit. And depending on the parameters and the particular leave that's being offered, the length of time, you could be eligible for up to $3,000, $4,000 of a tax credit for something that you are already offering for your employees as an added benefit. So one of the things that we're offering is the opportunity to take a look at a handbook, take a look at the policies that are in place, and say, is this something that you're looking to offer? Looks like this might be something you are short of getting at, but we can make these couple of tweaks, these couple of modifications, and craft you a policy that would make you, as the employer, eligible for this tax credit for every employee who goes out on this leave.
Jen, what's the cost of that?
$600.
So just so everyone knows, obviously, we here at the FIA Group, we're not a TPA. We're not administrators. We are not brokers. That's not what we are. Our job is to make you grow. Our job is to help you succeed.
Right.
So this is an offering. This is a service that I guarantee you most of your competition is not offering. They don't even know about it. They're not going to their employer clients and saying, hey, you can take advantage of this and actually make some money or get some recoupment back. For a small investment of $600, the return on this is tenfold. So it's a great, it's something great that one of our attorneys here identified on their own a few months ago. We vetted it. We said, yep, this makes a lot of sense. We could do this. It's compliant with the law, and it's a way for self-funded benefits, consultants, et cetera, to have an advantage over their fellow competitors. So
right.
It's great.
The best part is that it's very possible the employer already does it, and they don't even know that there's the opportunity for the credit. So start asking questions.
Great, Jen. So really quick, I wanted people to know, because we get a lot of feedback from folks asking for more Brady. They can't get enough of Brady. Oh, yeah. I mean, we get a lot of emails and texts and so forth saying, can you please have Brady talk about taxes and what's going on with, you know, the ACA. We are doing a webinar next Tuesday for MASAHU. MASAHU is the Massachusetts chapter of the Association of Health Underwriters, so it's NAHU, but Massachusetts-based. But the webinar is open to everybody, and there's no cost to the webinar. So there's a registration there on the bottom. When we send out all the slides, you can actually click on it and link to it. It's not a big deal. Myself, Ron, and Brady will be doing it next Tuesday for 1 hour, talking about the tax law and how it affects self-funded employers and the health benefits industry as a whole.
Just Brady? To add real quick, Adam, it's not the same exact thing as we did in our own webinar. We have some new material as well to go over, so just be aware of that.
Right, because obviously there's been new changes and new stuff that have happened since that last one, obviously. So real quick, what we're going to focus on today, problem, purpose, process, political update, pros and cons of RAPs. It's going to be mostly John Jablon. Out-of-network claims, what can you actually do? Not what you're doing currently, but what is there, what's available out there in the marketplace. RAP networks, we're going to talk a little bit about reference-based pricing, how it ties into these RAPs. And last but not least, just the stuff that we would recommend you do from a best practices standpoint, or as Ron and I like to call, the flagship. Next, what is the problem that we've identified? These are our young professionals who came to us with this. Healthcare's cost too much. Prices are going up. We're offsetting more of those costs to employees through higher copays and deductibles, which is not a good thing. So what's our purpose here? Make it more affordable. Why? Because every single person on this call, all of your friends, all of your families, all of your enemies deserve high quality, affordable healthcare. So how do we achieve it? By empowering your plan. Take control of the plan design. We call it learn, plan, save, protect. It's what we focus on. And the first thing we want to do first, as you guys can imagine, is what's going on in D.C.? Where are the transitions? What is changing? What are the trends? I'm going to turn it over to Brady to focus on that. Go, Brady.
Thanks, Adam. So here's a look at what could be the future. We'll wait and see, but it could be an Amazon delivering you medications at your home one day.
This is the number one question or comment that we're getting from people that are freaked out about this Amazon deal. Is how this is going to affect their lives, how it's going to affect their pocketbook. So make sure we spend a little time on that, Brady.
We will. So I think every now and then it's worth taking sort of a step back and taking the pulse of what's going on in the industry. And in D.C., of course, the news cycle moves very fast. It's hard to keep up, even for someone like me, who's a news junkie. And so I think, though, that at this point, we really can say that we're actually in a period of some transition. And there's a few big factors that are driving the transition in healthcare here. I think one big one, obviously, is political obstruction, right? You have a Congress that's unwilling or unable to tackle the problem of rising costs. As Ron would say, they're focused too much on the cost of insurance and the ACA, not on the cost of care itself. Another factor is the media, including social media. We have major news outlets more recently announcing, like NPR, Kaiser Health, and Vox, that they're going to publish monthly features about these sort of like bill of the month kind of deals, where they're inviting people to go online and upload their expensive bill from an emergency room or from a doctor's office, and just to shine some light on how crazy these situations can be. And we'll talk about a couple of them, but one was a $12,000 emergency room bill that was a surprise. One was an $18,000 urine test. I mean, these things are crazy.
To give you an example of how important this is, right? So recently, Ron Peck and myself came up with an initiative. We've identified local media here in Boston that is willing to take on this challenge as well, where we're going to use actual print media and, you know, local television stations to do the exact same thing. Go to the employees, go to the consumers, the patients, the people on the street, and go, listen, this is how much an MRI costs over here, but you can get the exact same MRI for one-fifth the price over here. And why is that you're being referred to a certain high-priced MRI versus the freestanding facility? So in order to do that, we needed to raise money. We literally sent out two emails to a small select group of people that we knew, you know, believe in the cause. And we were able to raise $35,000 from two emails, which is the cost to initiate and investigate and do all the outreach that's going to take approximately 9 months. So we're noticing not only here in FIA, but nationally, there's more and more interest in regards to the actual cost of things versus, you know, what the insurance might cost.
Right. And unlike, you know, other news events that are happening right now in the news, this one's staying around. It's not going anywhere. It's going to be a monthly thing. People are always getting medical bills. They're always getting medical treatments. So this problem is not going to go away. And the last factor I think that's driving the transition here, frankly, is big business. We talked about it before. It's big companies that are saying, we're not going to sit by and just wait. They're merging together. They're coming up with their own solutions. And, of course, the biggest one Adam mentioned before, and we've now mentioned a few times, there's a little more details about it, is the one with Amazon and Berkshire Hathaway and J.P. Morgan Chase. Each of the CEOs of those companies sort of brings a different background and expertise to the table. Of course, you have the fiscal expertise from Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan. You've got Bezos with his logistics skill and data analytics from Amazon. What they don't, and of course, Warren Buffett has proficiency in pretty much everything, but obviously insurance. But the missing piece there is healthcare expertise, and you can bet they're going to find some partners to work with to fill in that missing gap. But what we think is going to happen here, and what
you mean us?
I mean, hopefully it could be us. We'll see. I mean, I wouldn't maybe not tell you, Adam, if they reach out to me, but we'll see. I'm just kidding, of course.
Everyone heard that, right? Okay.
What we think they're going to do, though, what they mean by disrupt healthcare is they're going to use their size, and they're going to get better rates for their own members first, and they're going to offer a platform by which other plans can track usage, need, and customize. Basically, that's what self-funding already does. So I think it's fair to say that they're going to take a look at what we already do in our industry, and they're going to realize, huh, there's a lot of customization, right, and flexibility. I think a lot of our ideas will be taken and built upon by them. So just quickly, I want to talk about some of the trends of things that we're seeing in D.C. and beyond, and that's obviously about policy. And the biggest trend, of course, is the new legislation being passed. It's the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act we've talked about at length, elimination of the individual mandate, the executive orders that President Trump passed last fall that are really loosening the ACA regulations, allowing more types of plans, some that are even non-compliant with the ACA. We talked about in the previous webinar the situation going on in Idaho where they're basically selling plans now on their exchange that aren't even following ACA rules, and the Trump administration is not really even enforcing it. So that's a big thing to watch.
You know, a couple of days ago, for the first time, I heard the word skinny plan.
Right.
Talked about on CNN. And how a lot of these employers now are being offered skinny plans that, you know, aren't as robust. And they were explaining how it, you know, limits hospitalization and so what's coverage. But, you know, as a replacement for these, the bronze plan, as an example. But so stuff that we've been seeing and we've been doing is now, you know, we're hearing those words on the mainstream media.
Right. And look, and the truth is that you have a situation now like you had almost with medical marijuana, in the sense that if the federal government's not going to crack down on states that allow these kinds of policies to be sold, they're going to be sold. And so for as long as we have President Trump and the administration, that could be something we see in the future and expanding. Also, integration, we talked about the mergers and acquisitions just this week. Albertsons, a big chain, I think it's out in the West, announced that they're going to acquire Rite Aid and all their pharmacies. That's a big deal. Sort of competing or trying to, you know, make a move to compete with CVS and Aetna. United Health Group merged with DaVita last year. These are big mergers. If you look literally online at modernhealthcare.com, for example, you'll see all these mergers happening. They're happening literally every week. And finally, new technologies. Again, this has to do with Amazon and other big companies that just have so much of our data, frankly. They're finally crunching those numbers. We're using terms like pharmacogenetics.
What is that?
It's basically the use of your genetic sequencing information and data to come up with treatments that are more effective for you at a personal level. So in exchange for your cheek swab, for example, you know, they'll tell you what medications you are going to respond better to. And that's going to be what's going to happen, I think, in the future. And of course, these wearables as well, you know, we already have the Fitbits and whatnot, but there are new ideas. I was reading just before an article about like a contact lens idea that may monitor your heart rate. It's just insane what's going on. And so I think all these things are going to transform the industry going forward. Of course, probably slowly, but now with big players getting involved, you can bet that these things may happen more rapidly. So the challenges, these are not going away. We see these all the time, and our industry faces them as well. It's spending is going to rise by 5.3% projected in this year, and then annually for the next decade, 5.5%. That's really unsustainable. I mean, it's just insane how fast things are growing. And, of course, drug spending is going to rise even faster per year, 6.3%, until we can get some policies in place. We may see some this year from the administration about negotiating drug prices like they do in Europe and other places, but until we see that, we're going to see the cost of drugs going up. Of course, none of us are getting any younger except maybe Adam. So for that problem, we'll have to deal with.
Is it his review time or something? He's being very nice.
I'm just keeping things fresh. Speaking of fresh, I think.
Fresh, the urine test.
Right, yeah, that. We're getting to that. And so an insane situation there where you have someone who, you have companies who administer these urine tests taking advantage of in this case, the opioid crisis, and just ordering unneeded tests and combining tests.
How can it be a urine test for $17,850?
Honestly, I couldn't believe when I read it, but I would advise everyone listening to look it up. Essentially, what happened is this woman went to have one test done, and they ordered tests for like 27 drugs that she was not using that they said, you know, might be the issue. And they never told her what the test was up front or what it was for. They just gave her the bill. And so
one of my good friends thought his daughter was like smoking weed or something. He went online on Amazon, was able to buy a urine test kit with six. It was like $30.
Right.
And it tests for like six or seven different drugs.
Go to Walgreens.
Right.
Right. I mean,
my wife and I watch House on TV. I don't know if any of you watching this webinar watch that show.
Years.
I mean, it's a very popular show, but. One of the recurring themes is obviously that House is trying to diagnose people. And something that often happens is that they say test for everything, you know, and do these expensive tests and they come up with nothing. And a lot of them are kind of unnecessary. And being in this profession, I often wonder how insurance is going to react to those things. And of course, they never talk about it on the show because that would bore people. But you see them doing these tests and procedures that, you know, are worth hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, and insurance is just not a concern for them. And you know, that's not real life. But when we see something like an $18,000 urine test, I think, oh, that's something that Dr. House might have done.
Right. And it's a big problem. And I think also, given the problems, we can look and see what the politics might tell us for this year about how to address some of these problems, hopefully. One of them is, yeah, non-ACA plans are going to proliferate. That's going to happen across the country probably. We talked about AHPs becoming a big deal, allowing groups to get together who are not really associated typically to sell insurance.
I mean, you're looking at just look at the growth of captives in our marketplace already.
We're going to see states react. We talked about this at length already and having their own mandates and tightening their belts on Medicaid. Employer plans like the Cadillac tax, that's been kicked down the road again in 2022. That's a good thing for us.
Get rid of it and stop pretending that it's going to happen.
I think they forgot.
It's really absurd at this point. And finally, I think providers will face increased scrutiny because of these bills of the month and just more light being shined on them. And then finally, the disruptors and innovators will act faster than D.C. No surprise that big business moves quicker. And speaking of someone who moves pretty quickly, we'll turn it over now to John Jablon.
Oh,
it's hard to Adam, too. Very quick.
I don't think I can talk as fast as Brady. We need him to slow down. Can we get some more comments about Brady slowing down, please? That'd be great. Really quick, before we get into the out-of-network claims and what the options are, I want to make sure I ask everyone, we're trying to increase the number of followers that we have on LinkedIn to 3,000. We're just over 2,100. And I urge you, please follow us at the Fear Group, because we're trying to get to that $3,000 number. If not, Matt Painton will be terminated. So we need you to save Matt's job by the end of March. So traditional UNC, I think we all know what that is. It's the usual and customary language that you see for out-of-network claims that basically allows people to be charged too much, not have the right to audit, and to continuously be ripped off for year after year after year. This is typically what we saw, I would say, pre-2012. After 2012, we started seeing people put in RNC language. Not that it's usually charged, but that it's also a reasonable charge. I don't want to pat myself on the back for that, but I will. I'm doing it right now. That language also recently has been changed here at FIA. 2016, we started putting maximum allowable language instead of reasonable language, because every time you put language in, you would expect your opponent to react to that. So different than a baseball game, a football game. You put in a strategy, second half, you should probably change that strategy. Same thing here. Rap networks. To me, total scam. Do rap networks make sense for certain claims? Yes. Why? They're small dollar claims. You don't want to deal with it. The amount of the discount isn't that – the percentage of the discount isn't that high, but the amount of the claim is so low and they're so frequent, it doesn't make business sense or from a return on investment sense to try to have a different alternative to those. I can see that argument made. Reference-based pricing is growing tremendously from an out-of-network-only perspective. Not all plans are ready to go full reference-based pricing. I would argue that even those plans that are reference-based pricing, for example, all the companies out there that do it, from Payer Compass to AMPS to ELAP, not all these companies do RVP the same. Nor is RVP applied to every claim. Some have physician-only networks and only RVP on hospital claims. So that's important. Last but not least, tying carve-outs to reference-based pricing or how you pay for those carve-outs as an out-of-network, non-network type claim as well. So what are the pros? They're easy. If you're a member, there's nothing to worry about. If I, knock on wood, happen to be in Montana, and I decide to think, oh, you know what, the mountains here are no different than the mountains in New Hampshire, I'm going to go on the Black Diamond and ski down it just like I would if I was up in, you know, Lebanon, New Hampshire. Well, I would find out really quick that the mountains are a little different, much higher, much harder, much icier. Therefore, I fall. I break my leg. If I go to an out-of-network facility, I have access to a wrap network that will give me 10, 15, 20%, quote-unquote, negotiated rate. Folks, these rates are not negotiated. It's a network. They've been negotiated years ago. They press a button, and that's the discount. You can do much better than that, but it's very simple for members. You're not balanced bills. It's easy from a processing standpoint, if you're an administrator, how to pay and edit that particular claim. And you actually get a discount, 5%, 20%, whatever it might be, but it's a discount versus the full bill charge. That's the pro. What is the con? The con is, like we said, arbitrary inflated bill charges. You don't even know what those charges came from. You have no ability to edit it, to audit the claim. The payer, you have no choice because you've agreed to this particular wrap. It's an insurance company mentality. You're going to pay it based on the network rate. And you have loyalty. Realize that the networks have loyalty to the providers and not to the payers. And I would say one of the things about the wrap networks, and the thing we didn't put in here, is there is no loyalty to the wrap network by members. Employees have loyalty to their local network. They have loyalty to their primary network. They like their primary doctor. They want him in the network. But they don't care about the hospital or doctor they have to see when they're in Utah on vacation once every 10 years. There is no loyalty there, and I think that is important to bring up. So with that, we're finally going to turn over to John Jablon to talk about wrap networks as well. John?
Thank you. I am going to talk about some specific provisions that we have found within real wrap network contracts. If any of these seem fake, maybe too bad to be true,
just call us.
Yeah, call us. We'll show you.
We'll show you. I mean, so just so you guys know, this is the real. These aren't made up. Like, this is real. Like, we took copy and pasted them from actual contracts.
We sure did.
All right, go ahead.
So here's one that's actually not so bad, but it gets worse. Client shall adjudicate contracted claims according to the terms of its benefit plan document. On its face, this seems fantastic. You look at the plan document. You pay claims based on the terms of the plan document. Now, because it's subject to a wrap network, you have to expect that maybe we can look at the plan document and adjudicate contracted claims according to the terms of the plan document and then subtract the network rate from that. So plan document rate minus network rate equals payable rate, right? Well, not so much. Here are a couple of quotes that kind of undermine that last statement. And that last statement on the last slide, that is found in most contracts. Most contracts say something like, yeah, use your plan document, great. But then they say something like one of these. I'm not going to read these to you because you're sitting there reading them yourselves. But basically, what wrap networks tend to do is prohibit you from using usual and customary, reasonable, max allowable, appropriate, whatever term the plan uses, you can't use it.
But the key thing is, so this is language that you'll see in your primary networks as well, but there's one key difference, and we're going to talk about that in a bit. But these are the same, so the same scary stuff that people complain about, well, this is my network contract, you know, my people need the network, and you have this rub of, I need access to the network, yet, you know, I have a fiduciary responsibility to be prudent with plan assets. When it comes to wrap networks, you have a choice here. This isn't as simple as, you know, this is much simpler than it is in a normal network scenario where you feel you're obliged, you need it. This in many situations is pure laziness at some point in time.
Yeah, I mean, if a big claim comes in and you want to run it through the wrap network, you could choose to take it out of the wrap network. It depends on the contract. It depends on some factors. We'll talk about them later.
Right.
But when there's a wrap network, a lot of the times plans and TPAs just say, you know, it's under contract. We're getting a discount. Let's just do it. Just doing it can often be the difference between saving real money and saving fake wrap network money. Another provision there is regarding bundling, clinical editing logic, and again, reasonable and customary. What these provisions indicate is that when a wrap network says that you can, or that you should, or must even adjudicate claims in accordance with the plan document, that's not really the whole story. They're saying, yes, use the plan document to adjudicate claims, except for these provisions, which actually govern how much or at what level claims are paid. Because when you're looking at claims, obviously a contracted rate needs to have some force, otherwise it's virtually meaningless. But at the same time, the plan has put that usual and customary or bundling and clinical editing logic in for a reason. The plan is not looking at claims and saying, we will just pay the bill charges, whatever they may be, minus, I don't know, 4%, 10%, 20% even. The plan needs to be able to look at claims and say, oh, this is unbundled, this has been upcoded, this is a duplicate charge, etc. If you're not auditing claims, you're kind of doing it wrong. So talk about mutually exclusive, right? I mean, you have language that says use the plan, and then you have language that says, but not this part. And so the plan forfeits its right to use the savings or cost containment criteria that it has used for years, you know, traditionally for out-of-network, non-contracted claims.
So when we get the calls from brokers who say, well, doesn't the plan document rule? This is a proof, again, even with wrap documents, that you're actually not following the terms of your own plan. Because you're agreeing not to. And this is typical, right, John?
Right. Yeah. The question is, you know, but doesn't the plan document control? And the answer is, once you've signed a contract that says it doesn't, no, the plan document no longer controls for those aspects of the claims.
Right.
And that actually ties into this last bullet where the SPD, the plan document, becomes no more than just a list of services to identify what is covered. So if you cover, say, dialysis at, say, 150% of Medicare, if a dialysis claim comes in and it's subject to a wrap network or a primary network or any other kind of contract, that 150% of Medicare is irrelevant.
Right. And then when stop loss mirrors the plan, don't expect the stop loss carrier to pay the claim when you're paying it at Medicare plus 400%.
Right. That's the biggest problem is that stop loss says, but the plan document says 150% of Medicare.
Right.
That's what we have underwritten.
And that's why you're paying the premium you're paying is because they expect you to follow the terms of your plan. That's where the big rub is, and that's where the big issue we see in our industry is just on that.
Yeah. So one of the most important things to do, like every other aspect of pretty much everything we talk about, make sure your plan document talks about what you're going to do and make sure your plan document reflects what you are doing.
This is my favorite. Go ahead, John. Yeah. I lose my mind on these clean claims.
Clean claims are just a disaster. And I'm sure many of you listening – I've seen a lot of names that I know have had these issues because I know we've helped you deal with them. But these are just a few quotes. One is any claim form containing information sufficient to pay a claim. That first one's funny because who's deciding whether or not there's sufficient information to pay a claim?
They do.
Right, of course. The provider says, well, we issue the claim form. Therefore, we think this is sufficient. That's all fine and good. What about subrogation? What about exclusion reviews? Was it an illegal act, a hazardous activity? Is the member even eligible? I mean, there are tons of things that go into it that might render what the provider thinks is a clean claim not actually a clean claim.
But you have to still pay that claim within 30 days.
Oh, we're getting to that. I'm jumping ahead.
Sorry. I'm going to jump over the second right. bullet, too, so just so you know.
No, that's all.
I know you're an even associate with this slide, but I have to talk.
I'll touch on that second one quickly, but a clean claim does not include itemized bills, invoices, or cost data.
I want to talk about that one. Here's why. Many stop-loss carriers in their policies have that they have the right to see invoices. And we hear about this all the time now.
Yeah.
You might have a plan, doctor, that says you have the right to ask for an invoice. We want to see the invoice for that implant.
Right.
You're agreeing when you sign many of these contracts not to ask for those things. Or you're saying, we will not ask for it. We're going to pay that bill with this discount in 30 days. These are all things that cause conflicts and is what caused brokers and consultants to say, the heck with the self-funded idea, we need to go back to an ASO or fully insured environment. So that second bullet I think is very important for those of you who think if you require implant invoices, you just can have the right to get them. It's just not true.
Right. And, you know, notably, this second bullet here, this does not say that the provider is not going to give you an itemization or invoice or cost data. It just says that if they don't, it doesn't make the claim unclean. If you request that information from a provider, this provision alone doesn't dictate that they won't give it to you. This just essentially says that they don't have to.
And you still have to pay the claim in the 30 days,
right.
Regardless of whether or not you received that implant invoice.
Right. I mean, a lot of companies that audit claims and even a cursory review – without an itemization, there's not much to review. You know, there's only so much information you can get on a UB or a HCFA. It tells you very little. The itemization a lot of people consider it an integral part of the claim. So when a clean claim doesn't include that, that's just nuts. I mean, well, you know, submitting claims becomes kind of a circus. And then this last bullet, this is the one that Adam really wanted to talk about. If a company has to pay a claim within 30 days of receipt of a clean claim, but in no event may the company pay any claim more than 45 days from its submission, they're essentially saying that if the claim isn't clean within 30 days, tough. Once it hits that 45th day, you have to pay it anyway.
So no matter what, basically, they can write a number down on a piece of paper. It's not clean. I mean, literally, it's mud. Like, it's like grease stains. Like, you know, the pizza we just ate at lunch.
Right.
Like you still have to pay it within 45 days.
Yeah.
Folks, it's insane. This is what you're all agreeing to, especially on these rap networks that you don't need, which is what drives us nuts.
Yeah. So what happens typically is that clean claims become any claim submitted by a provider. Now, admittedly, right, some rap networks are going to be better than others. Those are particularly bad provisions we've seen, but they're not abnormal. You know, there are some that say kind of favorable things, like a clean claim is a claim that reasonably enables the plan to pay the claim, and if you need an extension, let the provider know, et cetera, et cetera.
And that's where good plan language will come into play. So we're already getting comments from people, can we deny it pending receipt of necessary information? Yes, but that, when you have a better policy, now you need good plan language to support your reasoning to not pay that claim within that time frame.
Right. So
great point.
Yeah, the question that Adam just referenced is why can't we deny pending receipt of necessary information to properly process the claim? It's an excellent question, and it's one that comes up all the time. In the plan document, of course you can. In the plan document, you kind of have to. But when it comes to the contract, if you sign away your right to wait for that information, that's the boat you put yourself in. So, you know, like I said, after 44 days, a claim becomes pretty much clean no matter what. And covered services, it's another bone of contention. And when I say bone of contention, I mean this is kind of the cream of the crop for where we see conflicts. Covered service means healthcare benefits and services which a member is eligible to receive under the terms of the plan. Now, benefits and services, what does that term mean? Well, depending on who you are, you might interpret it differently. Even the audience on this webinar, you know, we don't have a lot of providers listening in, as you might imagine, but even among the TPAs, brokers, stop-loss carriers, consultants, you name it, you all might have different interpretations of what benefits and services actually means with respect to what a member is eligible to receive. Is it coinsurance levels? Does it include exclusions? I mean, all sorts of different ways to look at it, but the one thing that's for sure is that when plans are paying claims and auditing claims and trying to contain costs, there's going to be an interpretation that is more favorable to the plan than perhaps it is to the provider, whereas the provider is going to look at it and kind of look at the contract rate and determine that the member is eligible to receive all the benefits in the plan. So, for instance, to use the example again, if dialysis is capped at 150% of Medicare, the plan might say, well, the member is eligible to receive benefits for dialysis up to a limit of 150% of Medicare. Whereas a provider might look at that and say, no, no, no. The patient is eligible to receive benefits for dialysis, period. Dialysis is not excluded by the plan. Dialysis is specifically covered. And the plan says, yes, but up to a limit. And the provider says, well, we don't care because the contract sets the limit,
right,
not the plan doc.
Right, so the actual service is covered.
Right.
How much you're going to pay is a different story.
Exactly, and that's where the different interpretations come into play.
And that's something we just see all the time. That's a major gap, major difference of opinion. And those are just words. I mean, we're talking one of two words that make a big difference in regards to what the analysis should be.
Right.
Great point, John.
Thanks. And the second bullet is kind of a converse here, and I'll go through this quickly. But clients shall, when accessing networks, compensate network providers in accordance with the provider agreement and using only contract rates. That's very straightforward. That's kind of the classic example of the network limitation. So the SPD governs covered services, but not really. But the provider agreement really governs what you have to pay. And, of course, the provider agreements are very rarely shown to health plans, which if you haven't experienced this, you are very lucky. If you have, you are normal. You know, this happens all the time when plans say, you're requiring us to pay based on this provision, and we haven't seen it. So how can we reasonably cooperate with provisions that you haven't shown us? It's crazy. So in that respect, the wrap networks are really no different than the primary networks in terms of restriction of cost and service levels and things like that.
Hey, before we jump into this one, I want people to realize, and I know it's your slide, Joe, but I have to jump in for one reason. It says, client will eliminate all current wrap relationships and will utilize this program exclusively. This is where things get fuzzy, okay? Because most people don't even realize all the different contracts and networks that they have signed contracts with where that provider might be a part of. So people don't assume that, you know, if I'm a doctor, I'm in every network, right? You want, the more networks you're in, the more people potentially could access you because you're in their preferred provider book, right? Online, on the website, whatever. So what you're saying here is, even though you might have a deal with this local doctor at 50% discount or Medicare plus 130 or whatever it is, you have a deal per, you know, per case rate. Many wrap networks have this language. If you're using ours, if there's any way at all that we're associated loosely or not loosely with that particular facility, you have to ask that rate. And the reason I bring this up as a major problem, folks, is that we see 2, 3, 4 years later, these companies hire audit firms that go into these facilities and look at the reimbursement rates, and they use these contract terms to then go after you for additional funds, and your stop-loss contracts are gone. Mm-hmm. They've expired, and yet you're subject to millions of dollars in penalties and fines. So I just want people to understand how important this particular provision is.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to say much more about it. I think you covered it pretty well. But I will say that I have actually seen two instances where plans have had very long-standing agreements with providers, direct contracts, and the providers have gone to the plans and said, I am going to join this wrap network, you know, X wrap network, whatever it may be, and the wrap network says, I'm not allowed to have these direct contracts, so I'm going to need to terminate our contracts. Now, the plan wouldn't have had those contracts unless they were favorable rates, so now the plan has no choice but to terminate that contract in exchange for getting whatever the wrap discount might be, which of course is not as good as the contract. Otherwise, the plan never would have signed that direct contract. So, you know, the wrap network contracts, they are not just damning to the payers. They are kind of harsh on providers as well. And, you know, providers do join networks for steerage, and so they don't have to have their bills audited and, you know, lowered based on clinical criteria and things like that. But don't think that these physicians and hospitals are you know, loving every second of this either. A lot of this is the network taking advantage of everybody involved. So it's, you know, just kind of another thing to think about when we're looking at wrap networks.
So I think this case is huge when it comes to wraps and how they're different than your normal, typical, regular networks that you all have part of. The Temple University case out of Pennsylvania basically said, you have the right to access the network on a non-exclusive basis. Why is that important? It means you don't have to use it. Unlike your typical BUCA or PPO network, when you're working with a wrap, you can actually say, on this claim, I don't want to access it. That's where the 30 and 45-day periods matter. You can actually, and folks, I hear this all the time, there isn't a claim system in our industry that you can't do this on. If you want to use a wrap network for every claim under $10,000 or under $5,000 because they're just small and you don't want to deal with it, fine. But there comes a dollar point where you need to be able to say, a bell's going to ring, a $50,000 out-of-network claim showed up, and I don't feel like accepting a 10% multi-plan or whatever discount I get, and instead I'm going to try to negotiate that claim outside of that wrap network. You need to do it. Why do I say that? You don't only need to do this because you have a fiduciary duty, in my opinion. You have a duty to protect your client's money and help them save money. But you can make more revenue too. If you're an administrator and you're getting 5 percentage points based on a 30% contract, and you're getting 5 and the vendor's getting 25, well, 5% of $80,000 saved is more than 5% of $10,000 saved. So this isn't just true altruism. It's a new and better revenue stream for your organization as well. So pick a number. Plug it into your claim system and do it. John?
Thanks, Adam. Adam touched on out-of-network reference-based pricing a little bit before, and he mentioned that it's kind of booming. And there are lots of vendors out there who offer reference-based pricing options. There are lots of vendors who offer out-of-network only reference-based pricing options. It can be very beneficial, and like Adam also said, for groups that are not ready to kind of take the plunge into full-on reference-based pricing, because as many of you listening know, there are a lot of nuances there. There can be the potential for a lot of member noise, et cetera. Out-of-network reference-based pricing is a great way to kind of test the waters and see what's going on in the reference-based pricing space while saving some money. So with out-of-network reference-based pricing, one of the best things about it is that you keep your primary network. Your members have doctors and hospitals that they know and love and have for decades. Most of them, hopefully, are in-network, in that primary network. You don't have to do anything to change that. It's just the wrap networks and the otherwise, you know, maybe the traditional UNC methodologies, those are what's killing you.
And I think it's interesting that I've actually saw a couple people send us comments where you do have the right to not use the wrap network, right? Correct. That is what, if you have one thing that I can get out of this webinar today, if I can educate the people listening on one thing, it's that you do not have to use the wrap network contract on every claim. That is a big, the number one differential. And that allows you to do other things, whether it's reference-based pricing, claim negotiation, whatever you want to do. So I appreciate the fact that people are asking that question directly.
Right. Now, there are always going to be some wrap networks that actually do require you to use it in every case. And obviously, our advice is stay far away from those.
Right. Have those contracts reviewed by us before you do so.
Yeah. And, you know, like anything else, stop-loss policies, everything. If you're looking to sign it, talk to us about it. Read it yourself. Talk to an attorney. Whatever you need to do, just make sure it does what you want it to do. So out-of-network reference-based pricing, just like other reference-based pricing, it reduces costs. That's the primary motivation. And it uses typically Medicare rates. They're accepted. They're understood. They're objective benchmarks. There aren't other real options in the industry for objective benchmarks to use when looking at pricing. And lastly, you know, when you're doing reference-based pricing, most vendors will make it look and feel just like a PPO. It'll be as easy as using a wrap network without all the, I don't want to swear, but without all the crap. So these are just a couple of examples. We'll blow through these.
Important to note the difference in money here. I mean, these are simple.
Absolutely. I'm just not going to read every word here because the folks at home are. But essentially, if you look at this one, a gallbladder surgery in Oklahoma, out-of-network reference-based pricing beat the wrap by over $8,000, including fees. So all things considered, at the very end of the day, $8,000.
And you're looking at being paid at 150% of Medicare. At 150% of Medicare, the average balance bill is less than 1%. So, you know, we're not talking about, oh, well, there's going to be balanced billing here. I mean, these claims are, you know, very well reimbursed to these particular facilities. What's the next one you got here?
Another example, heart valve replacement. This one beats the wrap by almost $83,000. I mean, obviously, as the dollars go up, so are the differences. But this one, like I said, it beats the wrap by $83,000, which is certainly significant. Yeah. And your stop-loss carrier will surely thank you for that as well.
The next one's the most amazing one.
Yeah. Premature birth. If you have not experienced a premature birth claim, you are very lucky. If you have experienced it, if it's been in-network, you are very unlucky. If it's out of network, hopefully you have had good options. But these are some of the most expensive admissions that we see on a daily basis. And this one particular claim billed at over $2.2 million. It beat the wrap, paying at 150% of Medicare. It beat the wrap by almost $844,000.
That is after vendor fees. That is important to bring up. Before vendor fees, obviously, it's over $1 million in savings. But that's important. This is net expense to the plan, a difference of almost $850,000,
yep,
which is huge.
And those are claims that ordinarily would have just been put through the wrap because why not? You know, what else are we going to do? Well,
right.
That's
so
what you're going to do.
This is what we have seen. And again, we have the data to prove that this is true. We ask people that don't believe it to come reach out to us and we'll show you the actual data. We've had a client approval even to give this type of information. We've obviously desensitized all the information. There's no PHI, et cetera. But here's the reality. If you take a typical, when we say average, we're talking about the average plan. Not every plan is the same, but the average plan has roughly 7% of their claims out of network. So we use a regular plan that has 7% out of network. We're not talking about a narrow network that has 70% out of network claims. This is a normal, typical PPO plan, 7% out of network. On 1,000 employee lives, not covered lives, employee lives, you're looking at savings of 74% over the average wrap network discount when you're paying 140% of Medicare. Obviously, if you pay 200% of Medicare, that number's going to drop. But we're talking $2.8 million in additional savings above what you're getting with your normal typical wrap, just on 7% of claims being out of network. This is insanity. So remember that, folks. This is paying 140% RVP out of network claims, only 7% of them. You're getting sign off when needed on these particular claims. You're going to save an additional $2.8 million above and beyond what you're getting right now from your wrap. If you're an administrator that's charging 30% for out-of-network claim negotiation, think of the additional revenue stream you can make, and think of the additional dollars that you can bring to your plan. Think of the additional savings that you can present to your stop-loss carrier, MGU, and their broker when they're trying to, you know, sell you on their policy next year. This is serious money that we think people need to start focusing on. So what are the best practices here? Do you need full RBP? There's lots of middle ground. If you don't want to just do a pure PPO plan with the wrap network, you can do a pure PPO plan with the reference-based pricing just for out-of-network claims. If you don't want to do any reference-based pricing on your out-of-network claims, you can still pick and choose claims based on a dollar amount that you want to pull out based on your claim system and pick up the phone or have someone else negotiate those claims for you. You still have to make sure you have good language in the plan, good language on the EOB, good language in your ID card. You must make sure that the repricer is accurate and accountable. This is huge. Why do we say this? Not all reprices are the same. Folks, I have seen companies, and I know John can attest to this, where we've asked an administrator, can you tell us how you came up with that payment amount? And they go, oh, we just paid it at half. We put down 50% of the charges. That was the repricing, was to divide the charges by two. Not really accountable. You need to have accountable repricing. You want to have good patient advocacy, ground level, proactive, innovative patient advocacy that actually reaches out to patients prior to services, reaches out to patients up front, not just when they're being balance billed on the back end. Speaking of balance billing, who is the fiduciary? What is their responsibility? Oftentimes that's cloudy. Understanding this is huge as well. Couple questions we got. It says, do patients get into trouble by signing off on documents at time of check-in that they're not familiar with?
That's
I love this question.
Yeah, it's a good question, and the answer is really that patients don't have a choice but to sign certain documents when they visit a doctor or hospital. I mean, obviously, if it's an emergency, it's a different story. But most hospitals and physicians will not be too keen on treating you if you don't sign their papers. Now, the papers, the one that's relevant here is the one that basically says anything insurance doesn't pay, you agree to pay. Now, that is sometimes cited on the back end when a provider is balance billing. Sometimes the provider says, yes, but the patient signed this document. The argument there is that that document is unenforceable because the patient had no real choice. The patient thought that they needed medical attention. The patient would have signed anything you put in front of them. And more than that, right, if the billing can be argued to be egregious, most providers will settle when they realize that there's a potential for a lawsuit, a potential for their charges being publicized. So to answer your question, I know I just got off on a tangent, but to answer that question, no, patients don't really get into trouble by signing off on documents because they have no real choice.
Right, and they don't even know what they're signing.
Right. If the plan is working on handling balance billing on the back end, the forms that patients sign are usually largely irrelevant to those claims. Now, if a patient promises to pay cash up front, that is something that we typically advise against because what patient can pay cash up front? Right?
But that's where, if you look at the previous slide, education is key. Patient advocacy is key. Getting patients to understand what their rights and responsibilities are is huge because if they're signing their life away, you know, we've seen people give credit cards and they pay the bill. Trying to get the money back from a facility, good luck.
Right.
It's not happening. One more question, then we got to end it. What precludes the provider from accepting reference-based pricing? I assume a settlement document must be signed by the provider. Not necessarily so. Here's why. Many of these network contracts have what they call, what's the word? I forgot it. Oh, man. If any of the BUCAs, Blue Cross, United, Cigna, Aetna, found out favored nations clauses, they know that if Blue Cross or any network says, this is the best deal that you're going to have, you can't have a better deal with any other network, any other company, any other payer. So many times, providers are accepting deals from payers that are a better deal than what they have contractually under the network. Therefore, they will not sign anything. But there's almost a wink-wink agreement, we're not going to balance bill, but we're also not going to put in writing that we've accepted this as payment in full.
Yeah. There are also a lot of providers out there who just don't balance bill. They don't want to inconvenience the patient. They don't want bad blood. We've encountered tons of providers who say, we're not going to accept this payment. And then they hound the plan, but they don't touch the patient.
Right.
That's fantastic. I mean, we love that because the plan can easily say, we paid you our maximum, now go away. And if we know that the provider is not going to balance bill the patient, there's nothing left to do.
So thank you all for joining us. There were hundreds of you today. We truly appreciate that. Please join us on our next free webinar, March 20th, 2018 at 1 o'clock. But don't forget that next Tuesday at 1 p.m., we will be doing that Masahoo webinar regarding the tax law and how it can help you and change our health benefit industry as a whole. On behalf of Brady, John, Jen, and myself, thank you so much for joining the FIA Group and empowering your plans. Have a great day.